Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast Supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
This is Writers on Film, the only podcast dedicated to books on cinema. Hello everybody and welcome to Writers on Film. My name is John Bleasdale. I am a writer and film critic, and today I'm going to be talking to friend of the podcast, Ian Nathan. He has been on before talking about Ridley Scott and talking about his book on Peter Jackson, and now he's here talking about one of my favourite filmmakers, Clint Eastwood. We go into it deeply, and Ian's book is concentrating on Eastwood's role as a film director. So that's the sort of the area that we go into most deeply, although we talk about other things surrounding. It's a really interesting conversation. I'm sure you'll like it. Please remember to, if you do like it, like, subscribe, do all those things that that help us to build as a podcast. We've got lots of listeners now, and I'm very proud of how far we've come, and we've really done it all with your help, dear listener. So if you're new to the podcast, let's get some new people involved, and if you're not new, then carry on the good work. Okay, before you do any of that, enjoy the conversation.
That's kind of where you have to start, is that, you know, the nature of the book, as I've written and as part of that series of books, is that it's him as a filmmaker primarily. So you have to kind of put that in front of the stardom. But of course, that's almost impossible. You know, they are absolutely entwined in who he is and who he is as a director and who he is as a star. You know, they're not really separate things. And I think he thinks, you know, his favorite leading man, as I say in the book, is Clint Eastwood. And it's a really interesting journey to think of him. You know, what is the point where the world, and certainly Hollywood, stopped conceiving of him as the guy who played Dirty Harry, probably the biggest star of the 70s, and started thinking of him as Hollywood's elder statesman, you know, the great filmmaker who presides in his kind of gentlemanly way over the whole industry? And what does that mean? And also to kind of almost strip that away a bit as well, the kind of august idea of Clint Eastwood icon, and say, well, you know, ask questions like, why wasn't he conceived of as a 70s filmmaker? Why wasn't he one of the brats? You know, I'm sure he wouldn't think of himself in that way, but he was making films like Outlaw Josie Wales and, you know, Play Misty for Me, even that were doing similar things that were playing on similar ideas. But it's about the fact that he was still this huge star, I think, is the reason people didn't view him as seriously. They kind of went, well, he's just the guy, he's the action hero, he's the guy who says nothing on the screen. That kind of weird sort of charismatic minimalism that he uses as a kind of an acting kind of tool was great, and everyone loved it. But it also sort of diminished the view of him, I think, as an artist. And it took almost, I think, to get to Unforgiven before critics and even academics. I think the French got there first, as they always do.
Yeah, damn them.
Yeah. So no, he is, you know, he's vital. And I for me, and again, I put it in the book, I think the comparison you almost make with Eastwood is sort of beyond even Spielberg and Scorsese and Coppola and those people. It's kind of with Steinbeck and Faulkner and the kind of the great writers of the American myth, or the great explorers of the American myth, if you want, you know, that looked at the way the country was born and the way it grew up and became. So for, obviously for Eastwood, that's the Western through all the kind of films he's made to present day. But there's that kind of feeling of his subject is America, and his subject is that landscape of America. In a sense, its vastness and its, and it's kind of the way it formed its own mythology. And I think that's what I found fascinating about him right through to now. Even if you watch a film maybe as humble as Cry Macho, you know, the last one he made and starred in, he, you know, you see his face against a landscape and it's still there. And there's still a sense of him as this kind of great edifice of, you know, American culture, that he's one of the most important figures, you know, in American artistic life. Because he's inescapable, and he, you know, he's been there since the late 1950s and remains. I mean, as we speak, he's editing another film. So, you know, he hasn't stopped, and he's well into his 90s.
It's interesting that comparison with the 1970s filmmakers, because it makes me think that one of the major differences might be, and this ties in with the appreciation of the French, that those 70s filmmakers like Friedkin and Coppola and Scorsese, they were all very influenced by the French New Wave. Arthur Penn as well, Bonnie and Clyde was, you know, kind of actually Francois Truffaut was going to make it at one point, and Godard, I think, had a hand in it. Whereas you don't get that feeling that Eastwood is particularly interested in the French. Not that he's not interested in international film. You make the point of Kurosawa being a big influence on him. But the fact that he's so solidly American means that he's you know, wholeheartedly, there's no inferiority complex there. He's wholeheartedly trying to do something American. And the French love that. They love Howard Hawks. They don't want to see someone trying to be French.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's, you know, he worked within the system, and he managed to work within the system at a time when, you know, the old studio order, which he kind of grew up a little bit with when he first got into the business, you know, they were still around. You know, he met Jack Warner. You know, he knew the end of that era, but he carried it on a little bit. He was part of the studio and is part of the studio system. His relationship with Warner Brothers has been like a, I suppose it's not quite a contractee, but it's very much along the lines of what Howard Hawks had with studios and Hitchcock and the, kind of the era of filmmakers that came before. So yes, in that sense, he's more traditional. He's more old fashioned. He, you know, he grew up in Northern California, quite an itinerant childhood during the Depression, moving around, slightly Steinbecky. And his father would just take jobs where he could get them to feed the family. And I think that had a huge influence sort of spiritually on the way Eastwood operated as a kind of celebrity and a director, that the work is what matters. And you don't complain, you get on with it. And you don't bring that kind of artistic fuss to what you do. That doesn't mean to say he's any less the artist. It just means to say his attitude wasn't that of a sort of auteur who didn't sort of, he doesn't like to talk about himself very much. So I think you're right. I think he's very much an American, but there are sort of odd ingredients that shake it up a bit. You know, his love of jazz music, enormously important to who he is as a person. He is a musician. I mean, he wanted to be a jazz pianist. That's what he wanted, but knew, he's one of those things, you know, Salieri-like, that he knew he was good enough to know he wasn't good enough to be a great. So he drifted away from it, but has carried on playing, obviously written his own scores. But if you start to look at the way he makes films and the style of his films as director, there's a looseness. There's a kind of jazz-like improvisation about what he did. He doesn't stick necessarily to full narrative, you know, laws and rules. He breaks the rules. You know, very few of his films, you know, naturally fit into the genre you assume them to be. Yes, he makes Westerns, and they're obviously Westerns, but they're very different from John Wayne's Westerns. They're very different from the tradition of what we understand. They're much more ironic and sort of obviously influenced by Leone, but they're much more kind of playing around with the form. Now, I don't think he's the kind of guy who would go, this is what I'm doing. You know, I'm going to break all the rules. I'm going to kind of reinvent the Western. I think he just goes, I want to tell this story. But how he tells that story and why he tells that story is kind of jazz-like. And that has something of that European in it. Has something. I'm sure he's watched all the films, you know, and he knows European cinema. I just think he doesn't self-analyze the way that those other 70s filmmakers love to do. And yeah, I've interviewed him a couple of times, and as soon as you get on to meaning and, you know, infer things or, you know, imply things in his films, he gets resistant. He's a gentleman and he goes with it. Yeah, he understands Unforgiven's relationship with his career. He knows all that, but he won't really sort of let that go. He won't let it, you go, oh yeah, that's, you know, I'm influenced by this. But just go, I like the story. That's, you know, I got on with telling it. You know, that's the Clint way.
The obvious European input would be the Sergio Leone Westerns, which marked his move from television into cinema. And the sort of the production history of those is in itself kind of really interesting, how he became very famous in Europe before he became famous in the United States because of the Kurosawa legal case against Leone for plagiarism. Though, I mean, I love those movies. Those movies, yeah. I think the God, the Bad and the Ugly, well, the Freudian slip, if you like, but the Bad and the Ugly is up there with what in my top 10 of films, I think. And the other two are not far behind.
Yeah, absolutely. He has a strange relationship with them, or had a strange relationship with them. I think he sort of made his peace with them now because of the way they were written about. But of course, yeah, he came, he was a television star. You know, he'd done Rawhide and, you know, as Once Upon a Time in Hollywood kind of makes a gag about it. He goes off to Europe because no one else will really have him to make films with this, who he thought was a chance. He just thought he was going to join some kind of runaway train in Europe, make a quick buck, and come back to America and hope things would have moved on, and he was going to escape the kind of thrall of Rawhide and the kind of traditional kind of character he was playing in Rowdy Yates. But something, you know, incredible happened in Spain with this Italian maestro. And it was kind of, it wasn't really a sort of a meeting of minds, but it was serendipity in the kind of the twin forces, Leone's exuberance and invention and love, but playfulness with the nature of genre, because that's all he knew. Yeah, he just sort of celebrated it and made it up. And you sort of pretended it was Western because that's what you thought Westerns were like. But of course, actually, it was operatic and wonderfully European, and very funny, but actually strangely quite profound as well. And yeah, this kind of rigid, but iconic, incredibly charismatic actor who was, couldn't understand a word anyone was saying to him virtually. And, you know, everything was done by sign language. Yet there was something going on in that kind of that juxtaposition of opposing energies that created, you know, the spaghetti feeling, the spaghetti mood. And the more you read about that time, the more you realize Eastwood was vital to it. I know it's Leone is the genius, and Leone and obviously Morricone's input and all those wonderful, wonderful things. But, you know, the costume was Eastwood. You know, there was no money for a costume. So he went out and about in Hollywood and just bought these things. The cheroots, the small cigars, which he hated, they were his own idea. And
Right. Because a lot of that is disputed. I've read Leone claims to have put stuff together. And so there is...
I know, it's kind of embalmed in mythology now. Sure. A lot of it. And I suppose I came from it, from Eastwood's perspective. But you're like, I do think that he started to understand something which about those films. He understood his place in them. And he understood their play with the genre. And I think he started to enjoy what he could do within it. And you, as you say, to get to the good, the bad, and the ugly, and there's such confidence in not only Leone's approach, but in Eastwood's. Mm. He just occupies the, you know, he's the gravitational center of the entire Spaghetti trilogy. He holds it down from being absurd. You know, he gives it the weight it needs. And I'm sure, you know, as he began to direct, and he, you know, famously, you know, the Unforgiven was dedicated to both Sergio and Don, it's in Don Siegel. But he really did take a lot of what Leone did on board, especially in the way he did Westerns. The Outlaw Josie Wales, you know, it's not a spaghetti Western. It's not Leone-like, but there's something Leone in it, in its kind of brio and its kind of enjoyment and its sort of the way it hovers on the edge of comedy, and but yet has this kind of wonderful sense of orchestration, you know, of spectacle, you know, of landscape. That, you know, is something I think he brought back from Leone. I mean, they did fall out. You know, they did. It kind of ended poorly, and Leone wanted him to do Once Upon a Time in the West. Famously, obviously, it's the role went to Bronson, who was offered...
He wanted him to do the main character, Harmonica.
He wanted him as Harmonica Man, yeah.
Ah,
he was essentially
right.
Written for Eastwood.
Right.
And Eastwood was done. Yeah, he'd made three films. He was now getting wealthy. He saw, you know, that they've been released in America from 1967. MGM brought them, you know, brought them finally and were finally releasing them. And they took off like a wildfire. And I think at that point, Eastwood said, well, I can do something with this. I can foment my own stardom within the Hollywood system. So it wasn't wholly a snub of Leone. It was a certain sense of his own destiny he was taking control of. But I think Leone took it quite personally, as only Leone could.
Yes.
And for a long while, there was a kind of silence between them. And it took a number of years, I think, before Eastwood sort of made his peace with his own past, I think.
I think it was in the Crest Frailing book, the story that Leone wanted the three characters from Good, the Bad and the Ugly to be the three guys waiting at the railway station for Bronson to turn up. And I think that must, maybe that was a suggestion after Eastwood had turned
up. It probably was a subsequent debate.
And Eastwood was like, I'm not going to be shot in the first 5 minutes. No way.
It's a wonderful idea, but yeah, it's a... You know, it's yeah, and you can see in Harmonica Man, you know, the way that could have been the Eastwood character. You can see the archetype is maintained, and yeah, it's probably a good thing that it, Once Upon a Time in the West is what it is, and it's glorious as it is, and it, you know, Eastwood needed to go off and become his own man. But the connective tissue, certainly as Eastwood as a director back to Leone, is enormously strong. And again, it's another thing I think that makes Eastwood so much more than what he's perceived as, and so much more of a 70s kind of director on the quiet, that you watch something like High Plains Drifter, even, you know, the lesser ones. And it's a kind of a remarkable journey to watch all his films in one go, you know, virtually. You get the trace, you think, oh, this film's quite strange. These films are odd. They don't do the regular things at all. He goes up at weird swerves and really weird moral textures, some of which have dated.
High Plains Drifter is a definite, jokes about rape and a horrible rape scene that's kind of,
yes,
as you say, has that sort of 70s, which, I mean, to I don't know if necessary to be fair to the film, but that was, you know, in the novel One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, the idea of rape as a liberating act was around in that period, yeah, of like Oz, of revenge, of a, it's a horrific idea now, but it was there in the culture. Eldridge Cleaver wrote about it, for instance.
And it's a fascination of Eastwood's, if not a minor obsession, certainly in the 1970s. You know, in a kind of very interesting and slightly discomforting way, you know, rape is continually brought up in his films. Poor Sandra Locke, you know, is attacked frequently in his films, and usually he saves her from a beat, you know, from a rape. But it crops up enough that you become a bit like, well, what is his fascination? And what's kind of contrary to that, and it's really interesting, is that he's one of the few directors to bring in and make very strong female characters, you know, in his films. You know, although he's always sort of written about and described as, you know, macho, all this kind of machismo, and of course there's that there, although I'd argue a lot of it is self-parody, the female characters are really strong, right from Play Misty for Me onwards, that they're written in very dimensional ways, and he's very interested in them, and he doesn't depict them in obvious, you know, cliched ways. He opens that up. He opens them up to threat. I mean, you know, everything Sandra Locke does in those films is becomes more and more fascinating when you realize they're in a relationship. But right. All, you know, all the, you know, all virtually all of his female characters, only for the beginning half of his career, probably right through to Million Dollar Baby, you know, including Bridges of Madison County, are fully dimensional. He's very interested in women. He's very excited by the idea of portraying women. Yet he also has this dark way of looking at them through this kind of prism of, you know, rape, this kind of theme that crops up in his films. It's impossible to know where it comes from. But it was, as you say, in the 70s, there was a kind of weird obsession with that as a kind of a fictional idea.
Yeah, I mean, we talked to Molly Haskell a few weeks ago, and she, of course, her 1970s book about women in Hollywood is called From Reverence to Rape. And she very much sees New Hollywood as all these men who are not interested in women other than as victims or, I mean, in the case of, say, someone like Sam Peckinpah, delighting in, to some degree, in the victimization of women. I wouldn't put Eastwood in that category. And I'd also say, having brought up Peckinpah, that he's an interesting character because I don't think Eastwood's Westerns are anything like Peckinpah's. You know, I don't think he's got a totally separate strand. I think Peckinpah is much more the disappointed romantic, whereas Eastwood is much more doing something entirely his own.
Eastwood is much more, I think, he's much more interested in what it takes. You know, it's this kind of survivalist idea. And again, it comes back to the idea of how was America born? You know, how was it created? What were the birth pangs it had to go through? Civil War, you know, the frontier, the kind of the idea, you know, in Unforgiven, it's this kind of central idea about, you know, is Little Bill Daggett, the Gene Hackman character, is he the most civilized character in the film? Because he's trying to build a house, you know, and he's trying to get a town to work, you know, but he's also a psychopath, you know, and these kind of weird contradictions.
And his house is falling apart, which is kind of funny, but also precisely the point of the metaphor. You know, you can't build a house and not get your angles right. You know, you have to. I just want to break off for a second and ask you a personal question. When do you first remember coming across Clint Eastwood as a figure? I remember it being on TV.
I'm slightly older than you, but we come from a similar era, I think, where we got into film. And I have such enormously important memory of being about 12 years old and being at a friend's house. And his father put on, I think it might have been my father, it might have been his father. My memory sort of is a bit said, this is film you're going to enjoy, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly. And when you're kind of 12 years old, the idea of a Western is a bit boring. Right. You know, it's what your dad watches. I wasn't quite sort of ready for kind of that. I wanted to watch science fiction films or whatever it was. But I watched it because that was what was on the television. And I just remember being gripped and almost electrified by kind of what the film did. And obviously, when you're 12, you can't quite articulate it. Mm. Looking back, it's how much personality that film had, that it was a genre film. But there was something more to it. You know, it had this kind of texture and this humor and this cool, this kind of comic book cool about it that was just mesmeric when I watched it. And obviously Eastwood's right at the heart of that. You know, you just want to be Eastwood when you're 12 years old and you watch The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. You miss out probably on the more nihilistic you know, the commentary on violence in the West and those things.
Never maybe. Have I seen so many good men wasted so badly.
That music is like an extra character. It's another dimension to it. And I suppose I think I've got memories of Where Eagles Dare and various. You know, my dad was hugely into Clint Eastwood because it was all dads were at that time. And yeah, he would go to his Eastwood film.
I remember not being allowed into Firefox It was like an A or a double A. And I went with my dad and they sort of went, no, he can't get in. I must have been about 12 or 13 at the time, and they wouldn't let me in. And I just, and being, so reading the novel of Firefox by Craig Thomas and the sequel Firefox Down, which is, which I have no real memory of, but he crashes the plane. And so it's all about him not being captured.
Not getting captured. I mean, Firefox is really interesting. Yeah, it's such an anomaly.
It's
sort of Spielberg's attempt to get in with the 80s. You know, this is what's going on around him, special effects and kind of big blockbusting, you know, kind of style movies, none of which he'd been involved in. But he has this kind of, and he does have this in him, this kind of idea where every so often he sort of looks over the garden fence and sees what the rest of Hollywood are up to and goes, well, should I be attempting some of this? Should I be involved in some of this? And he sort of slips out and he gets so bored with the special effects. He gets so fed up with the kind of discipline, you know, that's required for one of those big movies. And if you watch it, it's a really strange beast, Firefox. Half of it is this really dark kind of Le Carré-esque espionage thriller.
But someone gets their face beaten in to replace him. They have to beat his face in just so they wouldn't be identified. I remember being really shocked by that at the time. I remember, who's the guy from Yes Minister? Is it Nigel?
Nigel Hawthorne, isn't it?
Hawthorne, yeah. It was on Wogan. And they were saying, oh, so you've made a film with Clint Eastwood now, says Terry Wogan. I'm doing all the voices today. And he said, yeah, oh, it was awful. He said, Clint Eastwood kept saying all the way through the film, don't worry about it. Special effects in the second half are going to be amazing. They'll save the film. And, you know, you don't need to worry about the story or anything. And then I went to see the film and it was like, oh, not that good.
Nigel had a point. I remember being enormously troubled by the side of it. He steers the plane by thinking in Russian.
Yes. It's
like a kind of telepathic connection with the plane. I kept thinking, like, how do you think in Russian without thinking first in English and then translating it to Russian? Logic did my head in.
It just didn't seem to be that much of an advantage, you know, you're split second advantage. Just make your button faster. It's a funny one. But I mean, in a way, Firefox, he has these periodic moments, as you say, where he looks over the fence. I mean, the Iger sanction is a kind of, you point out, it's a kind of James Bondy sort of, you know, action. I mean, looking at it today with retrospect, it looks like something like Cliffhanger or something like that. But I mean, even Dirty Harry is him sort of going, okay, I don't want to just make Westerns.
Like, he is self-aware enough. And, you know, he's had a 50-something year career. To have a 50-something career, you've got to know how to stay relevant. You've got to know how to ride the currents of Hollywood. And certainly until Unforgiven, maybe, he wasn't this sort of eminence grease of kind of the Hollywood world. He didn't have the pass to do whatever he wanted. He never quite had that anyway, but, you know, up to the point where he became establishment, he still, like every other director and every other star, had to keep it going, had to maintain it. So I think he had an awareness that commercial failure is bad for you and commercial success is good for you. And every so often thought, well, let's try something, hoping it would be a big hit. Firefox made money and Iger Sanction to an extent made money. But you watch both those films and you can see the kind of Eastwoodness of them strain against the formula. So the Iger Sanction is this rather potty assassination spy thriller, in which he has to join a climbing team. It's pretty far, ridiculously far-fetched. He has to join flush out a killer, an enemy killer. It's part of this. I can't even remember why he's a member of his Iger climbing team, but he is. And so they have to find not only a spy, he's a good assassin, but also really good at climbing mountains. And he has to go up the Iger and flush out this killer.
He's also an art historian. I mean, he's basically Mr. Ben. He just goes into goes into the costume shop and puts on another costume. And I mean, I feel this is, I mean, I mentioned already Dirty Harry, but I feel that happens with the sequels in Dirty Harry, that when you see Dirty Harry, Dirty Harry, I think, is a masterpiece. It's an amazing film. It's brilliantly directed by Don Siegel. It's a really interesting neo-noir, you know, and again, like, it's a proper 70s movie. Then you go to Magnum Force, and it's already kind of more of an action movie, and he sleeps with a girl, and he's, you know, and it's just, it loses that noirish sort of, he's a loser guy, and becomes sort of like he's a hero.
Yeah, you know, Dirty Harry, Harry Callahan, obviously at the time it happened, you know, made Eastwood the biggest star in the world. It just elevated him to a place that, you know, there'd been stardom, but it was a kind of almost a new form of stardom that was invented with that. And I think it was both kind of a blessing and a curse to him. It was, yes, it made him stardom. It probably helped him get a lot of films made. It helped establish him as director. And, you know, it brought the money in. There's no doubt about that. But it was something he couldn't quite escape and was always pulled back to. At first, I think because he felt he wanted to make sequels and wanted to explore the character, and wanted to explore the phenomenon of Dirty mm-hmm. Harry. Kind of what did that mean? And then I think eventually a little bit more, he'll do a Dirty Harry for the studio as long as he got the chance to do Bird or you know, something that's kind of quirky and interesting on his, you know, on his own sort of behalf. But you know, it's a kind of strange mix. You know, if you watch those Dirty Harry sequels, no, he only directed one of them, which is Sudden Impact.
Right.
So they're sort of slightly separate from him as an artist. Yeah, obviously he's absolutely integral to what they are, the feeling they have, how they were made. And for a lot of them, he became the creative force without having the directing reins. He brought in guys who were second unit directors who'd worked with him, part of the Eastwood family, but essentially knew they were doing his bidding in terms of those films. And I think they get a little bit lost in that. Either Eastwood, you know, direct them and make them yours or don't. And I think they get lost in the middle ground.
In the second guessing. I mean, Ted Post was really critical of Eastwood as, you know, he saw like the first one he did with Don and he was really on it and he was, you know, he's great and everything. And the second one, he was just like, that's good enough. I can, you know, no one in my fan base is going to notice it's going to be any better than that. I mean, yeah, that's a disgruntled employee as well to some extent. But there's an element of he does leave behind some of these disgruntled people because he's, as you say, he's kind of taking over the reins. I mean, Phil Kaufman gets fired from Josie Wales. Yeah. And there's another director who you bring up who basically...
Yes, it's Tightrope. Tightrope. And
that's a great film, Tightrope. That's a really kinky film.
Tightrope's remarkable. And again, we come back to this argument that, you know, is he a 70s filmmaker? And you look at Tightrope and... Yeah, it's kind of getting into the 80s, but it's an older style film and so interesting because it sets up a kind of formulaic idea, cop tracking down serial killer, puts it into an interesting city, New Orleans, because it was written to be San Francisco, but Eastwood went, I can't do it in San Francisco. That's kind of Dirty Harry's ground.
Right.
I've got to do something new. And again, a smart choice. It's take it to New Orleans where they can shoot in real brothels and real kind of sex dens and shops. And you realize that the film gets less and less interested in the plot, the mechanics of who is the serial killer, and more interested in the character that Eastwood is playing, that he's a good cop, he's a good father, he's a romantic interest to Genevieve Bujold, yet he's also a pervert and a kinky guy and has this kind of dark side to him. And for Eastwood to sort of let that happen, to let that contradiction come into his character, seems shocking. But
there's a bit of Al Pacino's Cruising in there as well at one point.
Yeah. And because it's him, it's almost more unnerving and shocking, the kind of the sweatiness of it all, the grubbiness of it all. It's quite convincing because because of his rigid nature that he, you know, he's not loose like Pacino, who can just kind of throw himself into a world. Eastwood is still Eastwood, wherever he is, you know, in terms of the film. But that adds, I think, to Tightrope. It gives it this dimension of, he's just, you know, he's an ordinary guy with this side to him. And of course, being a cop and the case, sort of bringing it out, you know, into the open, that's quite fascinating. And that's so 70s, you know, what is this film about? Well, it's kind of about the case. It's really about just this guy and...
Yeah, character study.
Yeah.
So let's get on to the sort of like the moment where he reinvents himself once more in a way. I mean, although reinvent, it sounds a bit too much like Madonna, but it's almost as if like Hollywood is catching up with him and finding out, oh, actually this guy's, you know, he's been knocking around for ages and we still can't quite pin him down. So Bird, I think, is kind of a masterpiece. I think that's amazing. And I have a lot of time for, obviously, Unforgiven is a masterpiece. And then you have, you know, Black Hunter, White Heart. You have all these films around that period, which are just sort of like, I would never have thought Clint Eastwood would be the guy making these movies. And he has a whole bunch of them.
Yeah, it's, I mean, the traditional sort of way of portraying the Eastwood arc, the Eastwood trajectory is to go, he was Dirty Harry, he was a successful director, he made Westerns, then he makes Unforgiven and he redefines himself and he redefines his career and he sort of redefines Hollywood to a certain extent. I think, you know, as you say, there was Bird, you know, there's Outlaw Josie Wales.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary. Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom. Like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
There's a lot of those films along the way that the leap to Unforgiven isn't actually as big a leap as you think it is.
Right.
Yeah, he was getting there. And because his films were already, you watch Bronco Billy,
absolutely,
Top Man, and you know they're not as assured a piece as Unforgiven, but they're really fascinating studies of flawed men, you know, slightly insane men in their own way, and studies of America and studies of genre and sort of cultural contexts. You know, Bronco Billy is about a modern day Wild Bill kind of showman who is clearly nuts, and the film's kind of nuts.
It's Don Quixote in a cowboy hat.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's got the film, it's got this wonderful sense, it doesn't quite know what it is. Is it a Western? Is it a comedy? Is it a rom-com? You know, it's just got all these kind of weird parts to it that don't ultimately completely fit together, but it's a wonderful kind of journey to go on. And Honky Tonk Man is that as well. It's the singing, it's the musical, but it's the kind of self-destruction. You know, he plays this kind of country and Western singer who's got tuberculosis, basically. And so it's an arc towards death. And it's just kind of incredibly dark. he's just Dirty Harry. He's just the big iconic cop or the iconic, you know, cowboy is wrong. And actually we get to Unforgiven, but we've had Bird, which is an incredibly complex story of a jazz musician played by Forest Whitaker, this kind of incredible saxophonist, who obviously, as a jazz aficionado, Eastwood was fairly obsessed with. That is a kind of incredibly jagged, complicated narrative piece that moves around in time. That sort of does, it doesn't just tell you a linear biopic. It just does all sorts of complicated things with form. And there's an element of self-portraiture in there, I think, that Eastwood sort of understands something about himself and lets it out just occasionally, that he's got something slightly self-destructive, that if the career had gone another way, you know, he could have been Honky Tonk Man, he could have been Bird, that there's something, you know, he came from a poor background, he struggled. So it's not like he views himself as a kind of deserving soul, that, you know, the great line in Unforgiven, deserves got nothing to do with it. You know, it's sort of right. A fascinating sort of bridge of playing around with icons, playing around with this extraordinary idea of showing America for what it is and his own personal story wrapped into that. And that comes to this extraordinary apotheosis with Unforgiven, which, you know, obviously, as a famous story goes, he was sitting on for 10 years or nearly 10 years. So he was ready for it. He was old enough for it. And I think that's not just how he looked. I think that's about who he was as a director and an artist, that you've got to know you're ready to tell that story and to tell that piece. But that's, you know,
take a little it seriously, bit, yeah. Like not magnum force. We're going to do three or four takes if that's what we need, you know.
Yeah, and just I also think it's kind of, you know, he doesn't see things retrospectively like we do. He's not reading backwards, so he won't go, "Oh yes, I knew Unforgiven was going to be this major statement about my career. I kind of wanted to make it because it was my big thing, closing off a genre, ending an era, starting a new one." I don't think he would ever perceive it like that. Yeah, I think there's a subconscious understanding of the material that, you know, grew into this masterpiece, that he understood that there was a great thematic power in it, and it was intimately related to who he was as a Hollywood person and as an actor and as a director, that if you could throw it all in, that something would emerge that was very important.
But he kind of, I remember him doing Pale Rider and thinking, "Ugh, here we go again." You know, I mean, come on, Clint, do something else. And then so when Unforgiven was sort of like trailed, it was like, okay, another. And then you started hearing the buzz and that it was good.
Yeah.
And I mean, Pale Rider isn't a bad film. It's not a, but it feels much, it's interesting to put the two together, actually, because it feels more sort of run of the mill. It's better than that. But beside Unforgiven, it's, Unforgiven's on a different level.
It does have that weirdness. Yeah, if you look at most of his westerns, certainly the ones he directed, and maybe, I mean, Josie Wales kind of, they're ghost stories. They're supernatural. And they're all about, you know, these figures who are sort of part of the mythology. High Plains Drifter, he just arrives at the beginning of the film. And at the end, he rides away again. And you're not sure if he's even alive. You know, is he a kind of embodiment of vengeance? You know, it's there's kind of a reading of it that he's the brother of the murdered sheriff, but he feels to me like he's the murdered sheriff reborn. And Eastwood's kind of happy for you to go with that reading of it. In Pale Rider, he's, you know, the girl prays for him and he arrives and he's a priest and he's a kind of a biblical figure who comes in. And of course, he's got the dog collar. And he's a sort of, again, he's the kind of figure of vengeance.
And he's got like bullet holes over his heart as well. It's just like, how the hell did he survive that?
Exactly. I love that kind of slight frisson of what genre exactly are we watching here?
Yeah, gothic almost coming from Beguiled, coming from Don Siegel's, Southern Gothic of the Beguiled.
Yeah, just that way of stretching things beyond their regular form.
Yeah.
I think that's certainly there in Unforgiven, but I think Unforgiven is actually slightly more realist than that. It's, you know, it comes back to, again, it's about mythology and it's about legacies. But of course, the idea is to show legacies for what they actually are. That the idea of the heroic gunslinger, or even the anti-heroic gunslinger, is then plucked open. You know, that fantastic opening where once we get to Eastwood's character, he can't even get on a horse anymore. You know, he just keeps falling off the horse. He can't hit the can. You know, he's useless. He's addled. And it's kind of a fantastic kind of statement right at the beginning of the film that all those ideas you have of Eastwood are cast aside. Yet what they'll do is gradually reform as the film goes on. But they'll reform in a way that we as the watcher are starting to go, but should we cheer him on? Where am I meant to be? How am I meant to feel? Yes, the kind of the venging spirit is coming back to us, but I'm not sure that's a good idea. And that's what's brilliant about it, because you as the viewer are not allowed to be settled. You're not allowed to sort of go, yes, this is what I wanted. You kind of do. You know, the final scene where he goes in and reaps carnage, and it's not shot in a glamorous way. It's not shot like Leone or even like Eastwood's previous westerns. It's shot like documentary almost. It's blunt, terrible, and death is kind of abrupt. And you think, God, this is just so powerful.
You might want to clear out behind that guy before shooting him. You know, I mean, it's just like, it's just, you know, just get out of the way. I don't want to shoot you yet. You know, I'll get to you. I mean, we talked earlier, we intimated perhaps the idea of masculinity in Eastwood isn't as straightforward as it sometimes appears to be. And Unforgiven and practically all the films we talk about, I think the masculinity is really perched. There is a real sense of fragility in there, and, you know, as strong as it might seem. I mean, this film starts with a woman getting her face cut up because a man gets his penis laughed at, and reminding me of the Margaret Atwood quote that, you know, men are scared that we'll laugh at them, we're scared that men will kill us, you know, and that's I mean, you mention a couple of times in the book the sort of feminist Clint Eastwood, and I think there is an argument there, as much as there's also misogyny, and there's also, you know, it's kind of all part of the pie.
Yeah, absolutely. Unforgiven. It opens with, you know, a woman laughing at manhood. You know, manhood is mocked at the beginning of the film, and that's the whole theme of the film: manhood being mocked and undone. All the male characters, maybe with the slight exception of Morgan Freeman, are mocked and shown for much less than, you know, they consider themselves to be or portray themselves. And I think that does cross a lot of the films as well. I think certainly the ones he directs, he plucks open this concept of macho. And I think he's very interested in it because it's so applied to him through his own stardom, that he represented this kind of icon of pure machismo, that Dirty Harry is the guy who can just get the job done, even though if you watch those films, they're not quite like that.
The first Dirty Harry I rewatched recently, and he's absolutely awful as a policeman. They're sort of saying, you know, that we can't, you know, all that evidence that you got is inadmissible. And he's like, why? And he's like, the Miranda rights have been in for 5 years, Harry. You know, come on, you're a detective. You're not like an officer on the beat. You know the law. I mean, it's just, yeah. I don't know. It's like you already know this, surely. Sorry, I interrupted you. I cut off your thought.
No, but yeah, he's, and I think there's this kind of investigation of, again, it comes back to sort of self-portraiture, and exploring his own place as this kind of symbol. And even the first film he made as a director, Play Misty for Me, is about the arrogance of a man who has a one-night stand. And instead of, you know, him being the vengeful spirit, it's the woman who turns into the vengeful spirit. Yes, it's a kind of Hitchcock-like thriller on one level, but it's also, you know, he's got it coming. Mm. You know, deserves got everything to do with it in Play Misty for Me. It's, you know, he's been careless, he doesn't care, and she comes back at him. And she is just terrific in that film. And it's really a signal, I think, of where he goes with this idea of himself. And I think it's there throughout. You look at it, something like As Silly as the Gauntlet. And again, rather like Dirty Harry, he's a terrible cop. He's an idiot. She has to come up, Sandra Locke's character, the witness who's seen too much, she has to come up with all the plans. She has to kind of get them through things because he's just the muscle and a bit of a drunk. And it's a parody of Dirty Harry. He knows it's a parody of Dirty Harry. It kind of makes it fun. And you go forwards and you look at Million Dollar Baby. And, you know, it's a old guy who's lost his way and is railing with God about his life and, you know, what's gone wrong, his relationship with his daughter that's dissolved and has this new relationship. And he's sort of railing against the fates. You know, these aren't people in control of the world. They aren't control of their situation. It's even Heartbreak Ridge, which I suppose is the kind of the one that we're going to hold up as the kind of cliche of Clint Eastwood, the sergeant, you know, getting the kind of the platoon into order. But he's a guy who's lost his way. He doesn't belong to the army anymore. He's a creature of the past who's living on former glories, the glory of Heartbreak Ridge. And actually, if you watch that, you start thinking, well, yeah, it's self-parody.
It's absolutely hilarious, that film. I mean, it's really, really funny. And it's, I mean, I'm not particularly keen on the Nicaragua sort of...
Yeah, I think they needed some action and they kind of sellotape it on at the end.
Yeah, very obviously. I mean, he does have a loose and fast way with sort of historical moments as well, Eastwood. I mean, I always find him most questionable when he sort of puts himself forward as a sort of truth teller. I'm thinking of J. Edgar in particular. I also think Sully has this thing of like picturing Sully as this, you know, embattled guy who that he's being has to, you know, face this Inquisition. A huge aircraft lands in a river, they have an inquiry regardless. They're not picking on him.
Due process.
Exactly. They're not picking on him. They have to find out what's going on. It's you know, what I read about the actual inquiry and how the film deals with it is that that it was never for a second in question that he didn't do exactly what was you know, what he did, I mean they had to go through it and make sure you didn't have a drink or anything, you did this, you did that, yeah. You did all the rest of it. But it wasn't, you know, the film invents an antagonist in order to make the protagonist even better than he actually is.
It is true. There was a kind of late period, probably over the last, I think I'm looking at some dates here, probably starting around about 2009, 2010, Invictus, where he did Nelson Mandela, J. Edgar, you know, which is a film that's so much less than the sum of its parts. You're like, it should be great, but it's just not. Where he just sort of got caught up with biopics and this idea, I think, of himself as some kind of American historian. And rather than the wonderful kind of mythic work of the early career, or the early directing career, where he's dealing with America in a very interesting and authentic way, but without having to be historical record about things, you get caught up on this fiction fact blurring. And the films don't seem to be as sort of pungent. I quite like Richard Jewell because it's sort of an inside-out hero story. And this is kind of a theme in certainly in the later work, I think, about what is a hero. And, you know, and he sort of prizes that open. If you want to give the controversial American Sniper a chance, if you want to kind of say it has value, and I think there are good things in it, that concept of American heroism and its nature is what it's, I think, Eastwood's exploring, is that, you know, why do we think...
Quite a bit of fragility in there as well.
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, this guy's PTSD, he's messed up, you know, he's this incredible kind of marksman, sniper, yet he doesn't quite understand why that is or what his purpose is in the context of morality and the war. You know, he's fine if he just follows orders. And I think Eastwood actually does throw that open. He does look at him and go, this is kind of a tragedy, isn't it?
And I think sometimes this is also partly Hollywood's fault, because I know with American Sniper, the antagonist sniper was the invented thing, and that happened before Eastwood was involved. So it's you know, you can see the writers and producers going, this story doesn't have an antagonist, so we need to make a composite character who can be the antagonist. And it's just like, actually, you know, history is much more interesting if you don't have a clear-cut antagonist-protagonist relationship. But, you know, you do you, Hollywood.
I think it was Spielberg's idea, that one. Because Spielberg had American Sniper for quite a while.
Right. And Flags of Our Fathers.
Yeah, so they have this kind of thing where Spielberg starts a project and then Eastwood sort of takes it over. And in fact, I thought this is a really interesting example of the same idea, isn't it? It's about guys who are kind of held up as heroes by some public relations almost. They're kind of, they go on this Bond tour and because they're the figures who raise the flag, but they have no idea really why they're there. And they're greatly troubled by this idea that they're heroes. And I think that's, you know, that's kind of a fascination for Eastwood, certainly later on. And that must, again, be a little bit like him exploring himself, because he would have gone, why do I deserve to be this American icon? Why am I, you know, this you know, arguably one of the most famous people alive? Why am I, you know, the great Hollywood sort of godhead where I can do anything and I sort of rest over it all? I mean, I sort of make the point that he's sort of there to be Hollywood's conscience, you know, certainly of the last 30 years, that as long as Clint's there doing his thing, we can feel all right about being Hollywood, because he brings the respectability and he brings the authority. And, you know, we've got him. Look, we're all right because we employ Clint. And that's, you know, he'll just come along and occasionally he'll do an American Sniper that makes $300 million and we're all good, you know.
But it is that also that thing that, you know, I think there's a thing in America that we want our liberalism to be really tough. We'll take a lot. So he can be this tough conservative character with this gritty granite face and then talk about assisted suicide in Million Dollar Baby in a way that if that was Sean Penn doing it, it would be less acceptable. It would be the front and center of that conversation. J. Edgar can be seen as this sort of, as he was, a closeted homosexual. Clint can come in and do that, but he won't get much blowback because that's also the ambiguity that we have, that there are so many Twitter profiles and memes with, you know, Walt Koloski's face, which, yeah, you just think, oh, you know. And I saw American Sniper before I heard the discourse, and I remember watching it and going, that's a really good war film. The end wasn't great. This bit wasn't good. The baby was a bit weird, but but just on a first time watch, it was I loved the beginning with the training scenes and how that was filmed, and it felt like something new. It felt like if you didn't see Eastwood's name on the titles, you wouldn't necessarily be thinking this is a Clint Eastwood film. And then, of course, then you have the discourse, and it's good to talk about films. This is what this podcast is about. But you do sometimes feel that, like, the film has been lost in the wave of you know, argument.
I mean, I suppose a lot of that, a lot of, you know, that kind of blowback, if you want, came from the fact that it became this enormous hit.
Yeah.
That it wasn't just, here's this relatively successful Clint Eastwood film that might tread a little strangely in places and might suggest things, but it's up to you how you want to read it. Because it became a phenomenon, and I think it may still be, probably is the most successful film of his career in box office terms,
Jersey Boys didn't overtake it, I don't think.
I don't think Cry Macho sort of matched there. But I think people sort of thought that was a kind of America adopting it, you know, and there was a concern about, was it having a negative effect? Was that popularity, you know, a problematic thing? And you're right. I think within that, we lost track of the fact that it's a Clint Eastwood film, and in some ways it's a Western, in the nature of the characters and the nature of the portrayal. And it's an exploration of a guy who is a decent guy who's in a very strange place and starts to wake up to that. And war has a devastating effect on individuals. And it does portray that. And I think Sienna Miller is absolutely terrific as the wife. There's almost the kind of the prism through which you examine the film is through her eyes, because she's seeing her husband disappear from her. And I think that's quite an honest way of looking at it.
There's a love story there as well, you know?
Yeah, and they're the textures that Eastwood brings to things, that they're never exactly one thing. They're never kind of straightforwardly one-dimensional at all.
I mean, to finish with this sort of reaction, finish a little bit with where we began. I mean, I occasionally write for a newspaper in Italy, Il Manifesto, and their favorite filmmaker by far, I think, is Clint Eastwood. And Il Manifesto is historically the newspaper of the Communist Party. So to just sort of,
okay, well, react to that, but
they loved American Sniper. They thought it was amazing, you know, film editor there. And so it just shows that, I mean, I, to some degree, I would be arguing a little bit with them on that, you know, that it's not that good, but you just see how there's so much in there that you can, an Italian ex-communist can see it one way, and, you know, right-wing sort of blogosphere American can see it a completely different way, and they're looking at exactly the same thing.
Yeah. It comes back really to, you're saying, the central argument. Clint is so much more than Clint Eastwood. Yeah, he's such a kind of interesting director. And obviously, there's so many films you're dealing with, and it's such a long career. You're going to have many different kind of points of entry and many different arguments to be had. But at the same time, you know, I don't think there's a single film we couldn't debate for the whole of this length. We couldn't pull apart, because he throws enormously interesting things into his films. He has a fascinating looseness with how he edits and directs, and an extraordinary facility for character. I don't think there are bumps and sort of mistakes along the way that films don't quite work. Hereafter is a kind of an odd film. I don't think it quite comes together. Jersey Boys, it's a bit formulaic. But most of them all have interesting things in them and always have interesting characters in them. You know, he's so good at character, you know, not just the characters he plays, but all the characters in the films, that they're endlessly fascinating. I mean, the problem with writing the book was, you know, you only have so many words and you have to deal with certain films, you know, in a couple of paragraphs where you just want to write a whole chapter on them, because as you watch them again and as you start writing about them, you're like, oh my God, there's so much more to say about this. But you can't. So you have to sort of see things in broader terms, you know, the career movements rather than the specificity. But yeah, he's a great subject, but he's a better subject than even that when you start writing about it.
Right.
You start thinking, yeah, because he's so much more than what you expect.
Well, I mean, I've had you on three times, I think, in total. This would be your third.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if you're going to go for the record. What's your next book?
Next book, I've got a David Lynch book coming up.
Oh, when's that coming?
That's coming in about a month.
Oh, brilliant. So, I'll have you on again for that.
Well, we'll do a David Lynch show, completely different subject. But funnily enough, there are connective things. Both the directors, you know, both are great portrayers of America.
I was going to ask you that. We've had you on. I've read your Quentin Tarantino book, your Ridley Scott book. I think that was our first episode. We talked about that. And then Peter Jackson. And we talked about that in the second episode. And now we've done Clint Eastwood. And now you're going to do David Lynch. I mean, wow. There's a, you're doing all the, you know, amazing broad swathe of directors.
It's also quite terrifying because you get commission, you get publisher, and suddenly you're sitting there at your desk and you're going, oh my God, I've got to write about David Lynch. Mm. You know, and it's just for a moment you have a kind of panic and like, how can I even get hold of that and try and wrap it into something comprehensible? But then you're like, how can I say something new? You know, there's such good writing out there on David Lynch, probably him more than anyone, I think, in terms of the reading I did. Just fabulous writing on him, you know, really textured and really kind of involved, really mind-boggling. And that was really daunting. It's just as Eastwood was daunting. Yeah, you know, it's like, how do you get Eastwood, this kind of Mount Rushmore of Hollywood, and you put him into a book and hope it does something, hope it lives, you know? And it's always fear that you begin with, and a kind of excitement, you know, that you're going on a journey. And but yeah, always fear to begin with.
I was thinking of this the other day about like how easy people get distracted when watching movies these days. And I'm party to that as much as anybody else. But we've got to remember, you know, sitting down and giving something 2 hours of your time is kind of a weird thing. I mean, and now we're film critics or we're, you know, as consumers of media, it's we're sort of normalizing it. Let's binge watch something. But I remember just going into a cinema was sort of like you took a deep breath because it was like, okay, I'm committing myself to, you know, if I go to a pub, I can have a drink and come out again, you know? I can sit down. I don't like the food. I'm leaving, you know, but the cinema, you go in and you make that commitment. It's, you know, we have to get back to how weird that is in the first place.
Yeah. And increasingly I realize how important and sort of how disciplined it is.
Yes.
That when I'm in a cinema, I'm kind of, you know, I don't get my phone out and the lights go down and I'm no longer in the room I'm in. I'm in the film. I'm transported wherever this film will take me.
Yeah.
And I must commit to it. I've walked out of two films in my life, I think, for various reasons. I don't feel I should ever walk out of a film, no matter how bad it is. I'm going to see it through to the end. And I think you just have a kind of intimacy with that film when you're in a cinema that's totally different from anywhere else. And yeah, you know, I would love to be able to, it's impossible that when you start one of these books, to be able to have a cinema and just go and watch them all in a row. You know, with Eastwood, that might be quite difficult because there's 45 films. But
good God.
You know, just to be in that room with them. And I try as much as I can to kind of close off the world, but it's so hard. You're right.
But I mean, writing about Malick, there's only it's the first two films I hadn't seen on the big screen until recently, and I got to see Days of Heaven on the big screen because they did a new version, and that was an experience. But I haven't seen Badlands on the big screen ever, and that's always feels sad. But it's
You just think, oh God, should be seeing it in that right sound, the right picture, the right feeling. You should be going to watch The Gauntlet in a cinema in the 1970s with this sort of sticky carpet and sort of horrible, uncomfortable seat.
You should see Dirty Harry sitting next to Mark Ruffalo and he'll come out and say, you know, what happened to the Zodiac Killer? Ah, they shoot him in this one. Brilliant, Ian. Could I ask you for a recommended book? I mean, do you have time to read books when you're writing so many?
I do. It's kind of like when you're in the world of the book you're writing, there's a danger if you read, you know, not only read outside of the subject, you read someone really good, and then you're just like, damn you, you're just really good, and you have to kind of confidence, you know, crisis of confidence, all those things. But I am keeping up. I loved Sam Wasson's book on Chinatown, The Big Goodbye. I think I tweeted about the fact I loved it so much it made me angry.
Yeah. I hate it. I mean,
because he's brilliant.
And he's doing the Zoetrope one.
Which I can't wait to read, but I know it will drive me insane. Having written about Coppola, I know he'll write a wonderful, wonderful book. And I do find them inspiring. I do. I loved Dana Stevens' book on Buster Keaton.
Cameraman,
And I think I've come to the realization that there is only one genius in the history of film. And that's Buster Keaton. Talk about Kubrick and Spielberg and Chaplin. No, there's only one genius, and that's Buster Keaton, because he didn't understand why he was so brilliant. It was just instinct, and that's sort of the nature of genius. So I really enjoyed that. And so I do try and I'm reading Ian Penman's book on Fassbinder at the moment, which is completely different.
Right.
It's quite philosophical, and it's sort of written in a kind of a numbered format, like a long list. But a great sort of opening up of a world I don't know a huge amount about, that sort of post-war sort of neo-German cinema, you know, Fassbinder and Werner Herzog, the early years. You know, I love Wim Wenders, especially the early career of Wim Wenders. Mm. It's kind of wonderful about that world, but also the craziness of what Fassbinder represented. Yeah, you know? And so I mean, it's always a learning curve for me. I know you probably feel the same. But yeah, I'm learning my craft. I will always be learning my craft. And I want to read others because they show you how it can be done. And you get a bit angry and a bit upset because they're so good. But hopefully you learn from them and your next book sort of benefits from it.
Yeah, I mean, I definitely read your books and I'm thinking, that's how you incorporate that information in there. And that's how you begin a thing. And that's how you put all that, those different films together. And it's... There is a sort of like I sometimes say to Lydia when we're watching a movie, I'll say I didn't like that bit, but I'm watching it as a writer because so I can see that bit. You know, I mean, I'll give you an example. Django Unchained. There's a bit in Django Unchained where spoiler. There's a shootout and Chris Waltz has been killed, character has been killed, and they capture Django and they decide, oh, we'll send him off to a prison, to mining operation somewhere. And the writer in me is going, no, you force him to fight in the wrestling things that because that's the whole point. You put him back and he will, in order to save the girl, he has to kill one of the other guys, and that you give him a moral quandary, you know, and that's your ending, you know. So I can't watch that film without thinking, you missed a trick, man. You're supposed to be a writer, Tarantino. What's this bullshit about mining? He wasn't going around mines earlier. Why do you suddenly bring that in?
You know? Oh, no. Yeah, you're cursed. Once you start doing what we do, you can never fully stop sitting there watching a film going, start to write a piece in your head. You can't escape it. No matter what you want, you could be watching Paw Patrol and you'll be starting to come up with something.
This is Magnificent Ambersons. Absolutely. Well, it's been a joy talking to you, Ian, as ever. And I can't wait to read your Lynch book. That's going to be great.
Yeah, no, it'll be great. I mean, it's a different discussion. It's a different debate. But you know, it's a fascinating world. A little bit of a deep breath, that was it. But
imagine from Eastwood to Lynch. That I can't wait to hear how they're connected as well. Take care, man.
Cool. All right. Cheers, mate.
Thank you. So that was my conversation with Ian. We had a great wide-ranging talk. I mean, it was Clint Eastwood, but it was a lot of other things as well. I was sort of kind of going back into a history of Hollywood once more through these figures, through these monumental figures in the case of Clint Eastwood. I hope you enjoyed it. Next week, we're going to be looking at a single film, courtesy of author Dimitrios Mateo, Mean Streets, Martin Scorsese's breakthrough hit from 1973. Until then, take care.
Softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.